yo belo aiso dirralo ko yo belo aiso ilmalo ko yo belo
lolo mayati
loko yo.
That's Guyatu Robe singing with some of her family members sitting around a fire for cooking inside a primitive hut in a remote village in Ethiopia. She and the rest of the village now have access to clean drinking water, something that was a daily challenge before the San Luis Obispo-based organization Life Water International showed up. The local nonprofit is expanding its efforts to provide water to the world's most underserved populations. Hello and welcome to Issues and Ideas here on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. I'm Randall White. Joining us to talk about the group's current goals is Justin Narducci, the organization's president and CEO. Nice to have you with us, Justin.
Thanks for having me.
So, Justin, tell me, why water in rural areas? You know, some people, especially here in California, might think, wait, we're in the middle of a water crisis, you know, and you're sending these resources
elsewhere.
Yeah. So what's the plan there?
Yeah. So there's about 670 million people on Earth who do not have access to safe water. Almost three quarters of them live in the rural regions of our world, which tend to be harder places to reach, more resources to reach them, difficult to get cement to the bush, as it were. So it tends to be the rural poor that suffer the most from waterborne disease or inadequate access to safe water. In urban city centers where people have political power and influence, they tend to have their voice heard more, even though they face different forms of oppression. But it's the rural ones who have very little political influence that are kind of out bush people, as they might be referred to by the urban dwellers, who are pretty much neglected or left behind. So that's kind of always been Life Water's calling, is to reach the rural poor all over the world. Right now, we just focus on Southeast Asia and East Africa.
And what are the major challenges you find when you get there? Is it are they easy fixes? It's
sure.
Just that those tools haven't been readily available.
Yeah. So it's we call it software and hardware. Software and hardware. The software side being people's mindset and their understanding of best practices for hygiene, sanitation, and water use. So, for example, if we just did a hardware intervention where we drilled a well and kind of took off, the practices that are traditional in that region may not actually lend themselves to people becoming healthy. So, for example, they may not wash hands during critical times. So even if they have safe water to drink, they're still using fecal contaminants with their food, and it could still make them sick. So the perception that communities have is that the water is making them sick, when in often reality, it's water and hygiene and sanitation practices. So if you imagine an environment where people are going to the bathroom all over the place, you have flies that are transitioning or moving that disease all over into your home, into your food, into your mouth. And if that's not contained or dealt with, you could have a clean water source but still get sick all the time. So we actually walk with households, with families and mothers through these, we would call them small wins, like building a little hand washing station. And then they would start using that. And then we would come back and help them build their own latrine. And then they would come back and actually do like a drying rack. So you would have your pots and pans up in the air instead of on the ground where animals can contaminate them. Having all your garbage in one centralized location offsite, all of those steps are what we call a healthy home, primarily how they use safe water. So if you have clean water and you store it in a dirty container, it still gets contaminated, right? So all of those elements are really on the software side of human behavior, how people see the world and perceive their reality. So we start with software and move toward hardware interventions. So we start with health and hygiene, and we end with clean water sources that are constructed in communities.
Your organization is based in San Luis Obispo.
Yeah, I'm just down the street.
And but it hasn't always been, right?
We started in L.A.
And
yeah.
When did it move up to SLO?
Oh, about 10 years ago. We have a pretty strong volunteer base, and a lot of volunteers are actually based here in SLO. A lot of them are in the water industry here. And so our organization was actually started by a gentleman named William Ash down in L.A. who sold water pumps to people in the ag industry. And so a lot of his volunteers were well drillers. Tim Cleef, who's just down the street, is a consultant to many wineries around here and does a lot of work on drilling. And so a lot of those guys are experts in their field and wanted to use their skills to help those who would probably never be reached otherwise.
These places cannot be easy to get to. How do you afford to get everyone to where they need to be with the right equipment, with the right support and all that?
Yeah. No, they're hard. They're expensive places to get to. That's why these people remain unserved. We hire national staff. So one of the ways that we offset the travel costs is actually to have national staff do these jobs day in and day out.
When you say national staff, you mean people that are already living in that nation?
Exactly. Yep. So we'll if they aren't trained, we'll have to train them. But if there's a lot of professional national workers that are actually rising through the ranks. And so instead of having to have a me or someone like me travel back and forth all the time, we can actually place and hire national staff permanently in those places at a much lower cost.
Now, you're an evangelical organization. So does that mean the clean water comes with a message? Like,
no, it just means that we operate from a biblical worldview. So when we talk about things like hygiene and sanitation, we're doing it in this kind of meta narrative of God created people to flourish. And so it's not like a bait and switch or anything like that. It's just the worldview that we see the world from. Everybody sees the world from a certain worldview, whether we define it as evangelical or faith-based or not, right? And so all we do is frame training lessons in the concept of that biblical worldview. So at the beginning, God created, right? And so in the beginning, there's actually water everywhere. It's one of the kind of interesting narratives of Genesis, the Hebrew Bible, where water already exists before creation. So God didn't actually have to create water. It's almost like he's always had it for people to use. We just haven't put it to work in the ways that help us thrive and flourish. So there's no bait and switch things going on. It's just the worldview we use to frame all of these different lessons. Like the Leviticus, I know, commonly read book of the Bible, talks a lot about human waste and sanitation. And God talks about how he doesn't want to dwell in a camp where there's human waste. That's actually Deuteronomy. So there's a lot of interesting things in the Torah that talk about the types of things that we do. So we frame the conversation in that worldview.
When you've set up a system in a village, do you have a permanent stake there or do you leave?
Yeah. So our exit strategy is already outlined from the beginning. We actually will not be in a community permanently. It is their project. It is their asset. It is not us coming in and doing this for them and then leaving. So basically the hardest maintenance part is of the water asset itself, right? So people who adopt these behaviors, they tend to see the progress. They feel better. Their lives are healthier. And so they already have those changes happening. But the water asset will break down. It will. It's just it's a machine, right? Even though there's no electric parts to it, it's a pump and it needs to be repaired. So before we install a water asset, we actually require a water committee, which is essentially a savings and loan group that is funded before the installation of the asset. So one of the requirements is that before this installation of the asset gets completed, they have to have a certain amount of savings that they will use for the maintenance of the asset. So right now we're actually piloting a scheme in Ethiopia where the staff will follow up every month with the water committee to make sure that they have savings and that the asset's being used. So they'll actually do it over mobile phone. And then we can take that mobile phone information and put it into a database, and we can see which ones are breaking down, which ones have been maintained and repaired. So there's a lot of really basic ways to do these things, to maintain them without us having to be there all the time, but allow the community to own their process, their change process.
I imagine LifeWater has kept some level of statistics when it comes to the number of people helped, the number of people maybe who have not died because of bad water.
Yeah, we've, over the 40-year history, obviously I've not been around that long, but the 40-year history, we've served about 2.5 million people. So we'll never really know how many of those people would have died, how many of those would have lived, but we're really proud of the fact that we've been able to serve that many people. Last year alone, we served 50,000. We completed 107 water projects in 8 countries. So I play that out. It's about 1 every 3 days. And ultimately, the community has to earn all that. So there's a lot of work happening all the time that we're doing from just down the street here. It's pretty amazing.
Now, you just set up a field office in Ethiopia in October. And so the next one opens up in January in Uganda.
Correct. So right now we're planning to open a new field office every quarter for the next 3 years. So this first one was in Ethiopia, kind of central Ethiopia. And then the next one will be in eastern Uganda. And then the next one will actually be in Cambodia. and then we'll do it again in Ethiopia and keep going from there.
And where is your organization right now in terms of, is it the largest it's ever been? Did you guys scale back at some point?
Yeah, so we're growing pretty quickly. Thankfully, we have a lot of generous supporters and have been able to really ramp up our activities and serve more people more effectively. So we're projecting that this year will be our largest in our 40-year history, which is pretty exciting. We should eclipse about $3 million of revenue this year.
Wow. Well, best of luck in helping these people in the rural areas. I mean, we just take water for granted here. Let me rephrase that. In California, we know the importance of water, but we do take clean water for granted as it comes out of the tap. And
that's the truth.
There are people that are not as fortunate, and Life Water International is working to help them. Justin Narducci, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
You are listening to Issues and Ideas. Here on KCBX, I'm Randall White.